I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Doug Saunders joins me again. The Globe and Mail columnist and award-winning journalist and author has a new book out, Maximum Canada, Why 35 Million Canadians Aren't Enough. It's a compelling book that looks at the past as to why there aren't more people in this country, to the present as to what's lost with a country that's underpopulated, and to the future and just what an ideal Canada might look like. Prosperity can be had with a tripling of the population. It'll solve regional divides and secure economic and environmental sustainability. I'll get Mr. Saunders to tell us more about his book and just where we go from here. His previous book is 2012's The Myth of the Muslim Tide, and he was first on this program in 2010 when Arrival City was released. At Doug Saunders is the Twitter handle, and the website for more is at DougSaunders.net. Doug will be appearing with Gloria Makarenko on Wednesday, the 18th of October, at the Vancouver Writers' Fest. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets. This new book is published by Knopf. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Doug Saunders. Mr. Saunders, good morning.
Joe, good to be with you. Thanks.
As I was telling you before we started, I enjoyed the book a great deal, but what I liked about it was the look of, at the history of this country, and you do that because you want to show the reader the consequences of past decisions as to why we're here. We've grown in this last century, but why have people left? Because I think that's something that I don't think I ever thought about, is just how many people left this country over the last 150 years.
Yeah, that was almost the starting point for Maximum Canada, was that I'd slowly accumulated the raw materials for a history of Canada strictly through the lens of population, just looking at how the population had grown or failed to grow and who had come and who had left, and then looking at some of the policies and decisions that caused people to come and go. And the numbers are actually quite extraordinary, because really until the 1950s, with a couple of exceptions in the 1850s and 1910s, Canada generally tended to lose more people through emigration than it gained through immigration. I mean, all told, in the 90 years before 1945, so that includes pre-Confederation, mm-hmm. Canada only attracted 3.7 million immigrants, and at a time when the United States attracted, 100 million.
Yeah.
And it lost 3.3 million emigrants during that time. So only 400,000 people over 90 years came to Canada and stayed, sort of as a net group. Not everyone leaving were the same people who arrived. But we had an extraordinary rate of emigration, of people leaving Canada, both in English Canada and in Quebec. I mean, the loss of population of Quebec to New England was extraordinary. And I should note, I have a little passage called It Wasn't About the Weather, just in case people think that we didn't attract as many people as other former colonies because it's cold. The people who actually left Canada after making a go of it and deciding the economy didn't work for them, or the form of government didn't work for them, or the fairly limited colonial way that Canada was set up didn't work for them, they weren't leaving for warmer places. The efforts to settle the prairies in the 19th century largely failed. I mean, they succeeded in devastating the lives of the First Nations who lived there, but the settlers largely left the prairies until the early 20th century, because we just didn't have we had a terrible economy for them. But they weren't leaving for warmer places. They were leaving for the Dakotas, which by the end of the 19th century had a bigger population than the entire Canadian West.
Yeah.
And the Quebecois weren't leaving for warmer places. They were leaving for New England, which in the first decade of the 20th century, I think something like 19 out of the 20 largest French Canadian newspapers in North America were located in the New England states, and in fact, most of the largest French Canadian cities were in the northern United States by that point as well, except for Montreal. There were New England cities that had larger populations of Quebecois living in them than any cities in Quebec did at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So and again, it's a place with the same weather. So something happened, and I call the set of policies the minimizing impulse that caused people to want to leave. And it wasn't because it it wasn't because Canada was, you know, repressive or awful, unless you were Indigenous or member of some other minorities. Mm-hmm. But it was because Canada had closed itself off. It had decided, starting in the 1830s, really, that in the, or in the years after the War of 1812 went the way it did, that that we should not be part of a North American economy.
Yeah.
That we should not be an urban place, that we should be ethnically homogenous, and that our immigration should be very homogenous. And one of the extraordinary things I found out in Maximum Canada was that our immigration agents were very explicitly told, not just in the 1850s and 60s and 70s and 80s, but throughout much of the 20th century, were told that they should not be recruiting people, even from Britain, who were urban or had educations or had skilled trades or who wanted to start businesses, be entrepreneurial. We were very explicitly told that people like that were not wanted and they should go to the United States instead. So really right up until pretty much the period before the Second World War, well, until the period after the Second World War, Canada explicitly rejected urban and entrepreneurial people and sort of maintained this myth that it was just a country of farmers, yeah, smallhold farmers, even though, you know, by the beginning of the 20th century, we weren't a country of farmers anymore. We were very much an urban country.
So do you still see the sort of insularity in our institutions of government today? That, I mean, has it, is there some sort of this colonial mentality, is it institutionalized at all in the way that, say, governments function today?
Well, it's still a strain of thinking that exists in circles of Canadian thought, and you can see it in parts of our DNA. Look, I mean, what has helped us with this a lot is the people who came to Canada after the Second World War, and to some extent before. I mean, the fact is that by the centennial, a fifth of Canadians were members of this third force of the Canadians. They were descended from people who did not have ancestors in Britain or France or Indigenous nations. Ukrainians and Sikhs and Chinese and so on had become a fifth of Canadians by 1967, and they changed a lot of the reality. But there remained this undercurrent of what I call the minimizing impulse, and it remains a temptation. I mean, its last really serious lunge at becoming the main form of running Canada was John Diefenbaker's years, when he really tried to shut down trade with the United States and negotiate free trade with Britain and try to promise. He promised to shift a fifth of Canadian trade and commerce from the United States to Britain. That failed because, of course, Britain had zero interest in that. Canada had hardly any trade with Britain by the 1950s. Britain was trying to negotiate its way into what is now called the European Union. Both parties were, uh-huh, and it didn't happen. And that whole view, and that, of course, included Diefenbaker's attempt to say that there was only one type of Canadian, and that was a British Canadian. I mean, right up until the end of 1967, he was saying that there was no such thing as French Canadian. They were just British Canadians who happened to speak a different language. There certainly wasn't any such thing as Indigenous Canadians or anyone else. And that remained popular. I mean, there was sort of a symbolic tip of the hat to the that sort of Diefenbaker era minimizing policy during the Harper government. But those policies really did not actually become, I mean, in the Harper years, there was a nostalgia for that. There was a desire to rename everything royal, you know, royal this and royal that, and put the coat of arms back on everybody's business card and so on. And you could argue that the Harper administration was the most anti-American government we'd seen in a very long time. It was very pro-British. But mostly that was a symbolic nostalgia. I mean, we haven't had a government that's threatened sort of the maximizing package of free trade with the United States, growth of an urban and innovative economy, and fairly diverse immigration since then. All that we have, let's just say, like after the very difficult cultural and constitutional struggles of the last 50 years of, you know, the decades between the centennial and Canada 150, we have sort of a very fragile political consensus right now in all the major political parties and in most communities and regions in Canada in favor of a combination of open trade, population growth, and a modest but acceptable level of immigration. And that was very hard fought.
And so in terms of the future, what are the things, I mean, because you do warn us in the book about the things that need to be done so that there'll be a more comfortable Canada for all of us.
Yeah. I mean, this often gets sold as a book advocating for a population of 100 million.
Yeah.
And whereas, in fact, I'm being a little bit...
You're cautious
about
it,
raising
my
brow. I mean, a core chapter is called The Case Against 100 Million. That said, I was partly responsible for sort of seeding that idea into the atmosphere. That was because I wrote something in 2001, ages ago, for the Globe and Mail, where I interviewed demographers about the question of what would be the ideal Canadian population if we wanted it to be ecologically sustainable and didn't want to use up, have people living on any more land than we're currently living in. And the consensus argument on it was that if we only want to have people living in the current narrow strip of land with a few little spots here and there that we live on now, 100 million would be a good population. I mean, if we populated that same area of land to the density that the Netherlands has, we'd have 400 million people. So there was a consensus around 100 million, and the 100 million by the end of the 21st century idea had been an old one. I mean, government committees had recommended 100 million as a target population in the mid-1960s, uh-huh. Then in the early 1970s. But anyway, me writing that, that became very popular, and it took on a bit of a life of its own. And during the coming 15 years after that, it got picked up. That argument got picked up by a lot of politicians in both conservative and liberal parties. It got picked up by a lot of journalists and columnists and so on. And Irvin Studen, who's a political scientist, wrote long essays arguing for 100 million as a way to have greater strategic strength and so on, which is different from my own argument. Mm. And a think tank was formed in Toronto entirely around the 100 million idea. And last year, a federal government committee advocated a plan to expand the population to 100 million by the end of the century. So this had become so much part of Canadian mainstream thought by the time I started working on Maximum Canada that I thought, okay, let's slow down, let's step back a bit. And rather than, I mean, I spent a lot of time analyzing the extent to which Canada is underpopulated now, the extent to which our markets are too small to do certain things, our taxpayer base is too small to afford certain things, our cities lack the density to be as ecological as they could, that we don't quite have the density and scope of population to make the shift to a carbon neutral economy. But when it comes to talking about population growth, what I'm trying to do is say, look, yes, we fairly easily tripled our population between 1945 and 2015, but the next tripling is not going to be as easy, because we don't have the affordable housing in the convenient locations. We certainly have lots of jobs, and our immigrants are no longer people who just take jobs, but they're predominantly employers rather than employees. But we have a labor force that's much more fragmented and requires different income security supports. We don't have an education system that recognizes foreign skills enough. We don't have the right infrastructure in cities for the growth of neighborhoods and so on. So I spent a lot of time looking at what would need to be done to make sure that another tripling of population does not produce pockets of intergenerational poverty and ghettoization and segregation and isolation and so on. We do not want that type of bulk growth that leaves entire communities stranded.
So this tripling that happened in the 20th century to today, I mean, we sort of got lucky with it, and your contention is that because it'll probably get to, the population could triple by the end of the next century, to the beginning of the next century. It's just not tenable, is it, the way that the cities are built? So where do we, if we will triple in the next 100 years or so, where will these people be and what will our cities look like?
Well, first of all, even our largest cities even Toronto and Vancouver and Montreal have problems of low population density much more than they have problems of high population. And people don't quite make that connection necessarily when they're stuck in traffic
on the Lion's Gate Bridge
or the Don Valley Parkway or trying to get off the island in Montreal. But the fact is, the reason why we're stuck in traffic jams like that with inefficient transportation is because we have a modest-sized population in those cities, which is stuck in the infrastructure and the envelope of a smaller city. And we need to get up to a larger scale of population before we have the sort of density that we can provide us the rapid transit, the public transportation options, the intercity rail options, the public spaces and infrastructure that would allow us to move around more quickly, allow us to heat our buildings in more ecologically and efficiently, allow us to have the sort of networks that we need to do well in business and that sort of thing. Our Canadian cities right now have a lot of the places where immigrants settle, especially, are a lot of neighborhoods that are difficult to access physically and have low population density. Most immigration happens in sort of the high-rise suburbs in cities now. And those are places with low population density. I mean, in Canada, high-rise districts have very low population density because of the empty, forbidding spaces between buildings, which also are difficult for building of communities. They're harder places for immigrants to do the classic settlement thing of starting a business in your own housing area and expecting consumers with money to come by. We can do a lot, and there are some initiatives now that are getting things started. We can do a lot more to turn those isolated low-density neighborhoods into successful ones and to recognize that the old 1950s-style neighborhood with single-family homes on big yards, we can fill in a lot of those spaces between houses with mid-rise apartments and things like that, which would be good for those communities by making them more tighter knit and comfortable, and also by giving them the density to have subway stations and things like that in them. So there needs to be sort of an understanding that growth should happen in existing places.
Yeah.
I think the era of urban sprawl is over, in part because of the way real estate prices have changed. I mean, there's no longer a benefit to be had in buying a spread on the edge of town.
Yeah.
And the desires of Canadian home buyers are more toward dense areas in the center of cities now. That said, we need to be very careful to maintain our existing green belts and that sort of thing. The growth happens within those areas. Now, I should add that the places that stand to benefit the most in the coming decades of population growth, should they happen, are the medium-sized cities that happen to have universities and colleges in them. Places like Lethbridge and Trois-Rivières and Kitchener-Waterloo and Hamilton and Moncton and Halifax and St. John's stand to gain enormously because they have that combination of things. Immigrants to Canada now are overwhelmingly people with university educations, far more so than any other kind of Canadians are. And they want post-secondary institutions to upgrade their skills and become, you know, Canadian and all that. And they need places where they can afford to live and where there are sort of networks of people doing business and doing creative things and creating economies and so on. And so I think we can really point to those medium-sized cities as the places that are going to become the next population clusters. Those cities are also very hungry for new population because they tend to be post-industrial cities that have lost economies and have lost taxpayer bases that they need to maintain themselves. So there's going to be both a great desire and a great capacity for growth in those medium-sized cities and in the larger urban regions.
I know you have a great interest in architecture, and we're sort of digressing here a bit, but do you think there'll be some innovation in terms of, the architecture we'll see in cities?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's an appetite for more innovative places that have a cozy population density, but that don't feel crowded.
Uh-huh.
The definitive form of Canadian housing of the previous century, of the 20th century, the one that typified Canada far more than any other country, was the slab apartment district in the inner suburbs.
Yeah.
We built those more than any other country in the world, and the slab farm, as they're called. We have, I mean, Toronto alone has something like more than 2,000 of those, you know, 20 to 30 story buildings in its inner periphery already. But also Ottawa and Calgary and so on have large numbers of them, and they've become sort of the place of settlement in Canada. Those slab farm districts, which are popular among the people who live in them. They're nice apartments and so on, but they're forbidding. They create a sort of gendered form of isolation as well, where women in particular feel wary to leave the building at night because of the dark, empty spaces between them. What was the things that look nice on architectural renderings, the green spaces between buildings, become very frightening, forbidding spaces for the people who live there. And there's some smart initiatives. For example, in Toronto, there's something called tower renewal, which is a new zoning principle that allows the owners of those buildings to build low-rise housing and shops and little factories and restaurants and so on in between the buildings to fill in the empty spaces. That's important. So, I mean, one form of architecture is the one that mends the forms of architecture of the previous century to become more tight-knit. But I think the interesting forms we're seeing emerge now are interesting infill forms. Go to Surrey, B.C., where you see a lot of interesting stuff going on in taking sort of the garage shed outbuildings in residential neighborhoods and turning them into low-rise apartment structures and things like that. There's a lot of that sort of infill going on. Mm-hmm. Toronto has some of that as well. And there's a lot of scope for it in Montreal as well. So I think a lot of innovation has to do not with spreading out some building that looks nice in an architectural rendering across an empty field on the edge of town anymore, but of creating interesting living spaces and community spaces within the empty spaces that exist in previously built neighborhoods to fill in the density. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of the innovation in Canadian architecture.
You talk in the book, too, about the relationship with the Indigenous and how reconciliation really is a priority as we move forward. And as we increase the population in this country, what's key in terms of the relationship with the Indigenous that we all need to think about?
Well, one group in Canada who don't need to be told about population growth and its importance are the First Nations and Inuit and Métis groups who, first of all, for important historical reasons, are now the leaders in population growth. I mean, by far the fastest growing populations in Canada are Indigenous. After a period where their population was decimated, I mean, in 1800 or thereabouts, there were something like 2 million Indigenous people in Canada, and then it fell to below 200,000 by the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, some people use the word genocide, and when you look at those numbers, you realize that, you know, there's really something to that idea. But there's been a big recovery of population since the 1960s. Really, the 1960s were the beginning of an awakening of Indigenous nations, not really out of any goodwill on behalf of Canadian governments, but because they became conscious themselves. Indigenous people only got the vote in 1961. Most living Indigenous First Nations families have a family member who endured the abuse of the residential schools. So it's, you know, the bad times are very, very recent. The political awakening is very new. It was only in the 1980s that we finally returned to where we'd started, which is recognizing the treaty documents of early Canada as being our constitutional documents, or recognizing Aboriginal title as being the foundation of our constitutional reality, which the Charter of Rights and the Constitution Act both now recognize. So we have this platform for a revival of Indigenous nations, and they've had very, very rapid population growth since then, and sort of a recognition that a big factor in making, particularly on reserve communities, making them work well and function well is building up the population density. It's not a contest of who has the biggest relative population. It's a matter of having a strong enough absolute population density to be able to, you know, provide the right sort of schools, the right sort of resources, the right sort of business success and things like that. And you could say that, you know, Indigenous nations are kind of leading the way in looking at at population that way as something that, that can be both ecologically beneficial and beneficial for human development, so sustainability. There's a long way to go, but the talk about population is not a competition. It's a matter of sort of cooperative efforts to do this together.
So there's so much in this book that I want to talk to you about. I mean, I could talk all day with you on it. I want to end with this, Doug. You're a columnist at the Globe and Mail, and I want to ask you about fellow columnists in the sort of current or past, but whenever you see one of your colleagues making the news or trending on Twitter, being talked about on podcasts and the sort, I mean, is there a little bit of you that says, well, I'm glad it's not me?
I tend to just do my stuff, and I don't tend to look at the internal operations of the Globe and Mail too much, and I have a lot of colleagues who are doing great work now too. So it's always been a fragile industry, and it's a tricky industry now, but right now it still remains a good platform for doing my work.
And you know, I mean, you do realize what a powerful platform it is week after week.
The Globe and Mail has provided me with a lot of support for branching out and doing projects like this. I mean, Maximum Canada was kind of built out of a set of essays that I wrote over a 15-year period when I was living outside Canada, when I was in Los Angeles, and then when I was in living in Britain and running the European Bureau, and I always had a lot of leeway to do strange things like write historical essays about Canada while I was covering French elections and things like that. So there's a lot of gratitude toward the long leash that I've been given at the Globe and Mail.
And I guess the perspective that you gain living abroad about this country, I mean, is that one of the reasons why that you've come back?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You look at your own country differently when you're abroad, when you're looking at it as being a foreign country and an object of study rather than this thing that swirls around you. And you start to see when you're outside, you think, okay, well, Canada is interesting because it developed very differently from other colonies of settlement that had some similar characteristics, but that developed differently. What was it about that? So I don't think Maximum Canada would have been a possible book if I'd not lived outside of Canada for a long time. And not without, you know, with the great love of Canada. I mean, I live here now after a decade and a half of being away more than I was here, and putting my kids through high school here and that sort of thing. So in many ways, it's sort of a love letter to Canada and a recognition that its strange past has led us into some awkward moments you can acknowledge the awkwardness of your parenting while looking for the best for your future.
Yeah. What when you think of this book, Maximum Canada, and who needs to read it? I mean, you mentioned your kids. I guess those are the two that you dedicate the book to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they were both born in the beginning of this century, so they're sort of Canada 150 kids. and that's a nostalgic thing for me because I was a centennial baby.
Uh-huh.
My parents missed Expo 67 because I was busy being born.
Yeah.
So I've always sort of seen, the first century of Canada and the second century as being placed a stark division, which I think is partly a realistic historical interpretation. But I'll acknowledge it's partly because that's when I was born and time began for me then. But my own kids will paint the rest of that picture. From a moment that began right around the 150-year mark.
So I don't know if people of their generation are hip to this yet, but, I mean, do you find that you are where the people in this country are? I mean, I've seen the tweets that you've been getting in terms of this book and some of the things you're talking about. A lot of people are reticent to embrace some of the ideas in terms of immigration or attracting immigrants or refugees to this country.
Well, there's sort of a mainstream consensus around sensible controlled immigration and growth and population growth in Canada. I mean, I think we are at a fortunate moment. I mean, of course, there's always going to be noisy factions who feel otherwise. But I think we are. I'm partly writing this because I'm talking to Canadians who generally are of similar mind about this. And that doesn't mean it can't all fall apart or that we can't have difficult times in the future. But the fact is we do need to recognize that regardless of what we do, we probably will have a growing population. It would be very hard not to. And what it would take to actually have a non-growing population, aside from the pain of doing that and the extraordinary expense it would bring, would be to move against a very strong political consensus in Canada. So this is partly to say, okay, we've all come to somewhere similar, and it's somewhere sort of like the same place in this. Let's figure out how to make it work.
Well, the conversation continues. Congratulations on this book, Doug, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks, Joe. This is terrific.
Maximum Canada is the title of the book, Why 35 Million Canadians Aren't Enough. It's published by Knopf. Doug Saunders, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.